live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, local election results. In Sullivan County, Sheriff Mike Schiff holds on to his badge after a write-in challenge. And in Highland, Superintendent John Pizzolatto and his lifting neighbors slate sweep. In Pennsylvania, voters across the Commonwealth decided to keep the state's top judges in place. All three Democratic Supreme Court justices won another 10 years on the bench. And in Honesdale, voters stuck with familiar faces, too. We'll get results and analysis from our partners and our staff, and we'll get results from Ulster, Orange, and Delaware counties. We'll also hear from the Republican and Democratic Party leaders in Sullivan County. And in some non-political news, diamonds, devotion, and a bond that outlasted the stage. Ann Talman brings the heart of Elizabeth Taylor to life in Narrowsburg this weekend. It's all coming up.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks opened higher this morning as the U.S. Supreme Court weighs the legality of President Trump's tariffs. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 150 points in early trading.
The high court's being asked to decide whether President Trump went too far in slapping tariffs on virtually everything the U.S. imports, using a 1970s law that never mentions the word tariffs. The import taxes are being challenged by a number of small businesses and states. The average McDonald's customer is spending a little bit more, helping to boost the chain's quarterly sales in the U.S. by nearly 2.5%. The fast food giant brought back snack wraps for the first time in years as it continues to try to win over cost-cutting customers. Pfizer says sales of its COVID-19 vaccine are off to a slow start this fall after the federal government narrowed its recommendation for who should get the shots. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Democrats won key races in yesterday's elections. Two Democrats won gubernatorial races in New Jersey and Virginia, and Democratic Socialist Zora Mamdani won the New York City mayoral election. Exit polls from CNN show that of the voters who cited the cost of living as a top issue, 6 in 10 of them sided with Democrats. Mamdani ran on promises to make New York City more affordable, and he's explaining how he'll fund his priorities.
You have to raise taxes on the top 1% of New Yorkers, New Yorkers who make more than $1 million a year, and you do that by raising taxes on by them 2%. And then you also increase the corporate tax of New York State to match that of New Jersey. So that takes us from about 7.25 to about 11.5%, which is what we see in New Jersey.
He spoke to ABC's Good Morning America. Voters in Colorado have approved a measure to raise taxes on more affluent residents. That money will be used to pay for food assistance. California voters have overwhelmingly backed a ballot measure. It will allow state lawmakers to redraw California's congressional district maps. The goal is to try to send 5 more Democrats to Congress. Voters in Missouri's largest school district have approved a 4-day school week. From member station KCUR in Kansas City, Jody Fortino has more.
The independent school district, located in a Kansas City suburb, adopted the shorter week 2 years ago to attract more teachers amid a statewide shortage. But a new Missouri law requires that larger school districts get voter approval by the next school year to start or continue a 4-day week. About a third of the state's school districts are participating in a 4-day week as they navigate how to keep educators while struggling with limited resources to raise salaries. Most of the school districts on the shorter week are small and located in rural areas, but the win in independence may push more suburban schools to consider changing their schedule. For NPR News, I'm Jody Fortino in Kansas City.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The federal government shutdown is now 36 days old. President Trump has said he won't negotiate with Democrats on a spending bill. He welcomed Republican senators to the White House this morning, and he demanded that they overturn the filibuster to pass a spending measure. Republican senators have been very reluctant to overturn the filibuster. Senate Democrats say ICE is ignoring their questions about an apparent new facial recognition system. As NPR's Martin Costi tells us, lawmakers are following up on reports of federal agents in Chicago scanning people's faces with their phones.
The senators wrote to ICE in September demanding it stop using facial recognition in the field. Senator Edward Markey of Massachusetts says there are too many unanswered questions. For instance, does this system identify just a limited number of wanted people, or does it have access to larger databases that can identify the general public?
I don't know, and if I don't know, the Congress doesn't know, and if the Congress doesn't know, the American people don't know. This is a technology being deployed by the Trump administration against the American people.
Markey and fellow Democrats renewed their request for information on Monday. ICE has not yet replied, nor did it answer a request for comment from NPR. Martin Costi, NPR News.
Japan's government is sending military troops to a northern region to deal with bears. Japan says that since April, at least 12 people have been killed in bear attacks and more than 100 others have been hurt. Japan's military will catch the bears for local hunters to then kill. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. We got election results, and on the first major election night since Donald Trump's return to power, Democrats nationally outperformed even their most optimistic expectations. Zohran Mamdani delivered a decisive win over Trump-backed Andrew Cuomo in the race for mayor of New York City. Meanwhile, Mikey Sherrill and Abigail Spanberger captured the governorships in New Jersey and Virginia by double-digit margins, far surpassing Kamala Harris's performance against Trump at this point last year. Locally, there were some good news for Democrats as well, and for some local reaction, we are joined by Stephen Veglianti, chair of the Sullivan County Democrat Party. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I want to ask you about the local results, but first, what's your reaction to the national results? It seems as if there was a bit of a blue wave last night.
You know, yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, it's representative of people's dissatisfaction with this administration on a national level. And I think that filters down to the local level as well. I think it's hopefully, the marking of the walk back to sanity.
Let's talk about those local results in Sullivan County. How did Democrats do last night in your view?
Well, we're still going through all the results and, nothing's official, but we're pretty happy with with both the turnout. I think there was robust turnout throughout, a lot of the districts that don't always see it. We're happy with a lot of the town level results. Obviously, we're happy that we have our Democratic elected treasurer. And I was, very interested. It was very interesting to see the degree to which write-in candidates made impressive showings, throughout some town races and on the sheriff's race.
Yeah,
it just goes to show you that the electorate is motivated, and it's really up to us as a party now to explain our ideals and focus that enthusiasm into next year's elections.
Yeah, the write-ins did certainly influence the election, and we're still waiting for some official results, as you said. At the town level, I want to just highlight one town, the town of Highland. It looks like the incumbent Democrat, John Pizzolatto, did well in that race.
Yep. John's done, from my perspective and what I know of Highland, it's not my hometown, obviously, but from what I've seen and what I've spoken to people, he's really put together a coalition of residents that support his vision and support his views on improving the town. And I think he's kind of the reason he's been successful. And I applaud him. I congratulate him on his win.
And how does this win last night at the national level and some of the highlights at the local level in Sullivan County, how does that influence strategy for the Sullivan County Democrats moving forward into the midterms?
The funny thing about, we are a Big Ten party. We always have been a Big Ten party. And no matter where you fall on the spectrum in the Democratic Party, I think you can make the argument that your views won out last night. But I think the most important thing is for everyone to understand it's the electorate in the election district that you're looking at that really makes that decision, right? So New York City is a very liberal city, and it elected a very liberal mayor. And that should be applauded. I mean, I think if you want to, they'll be teaching the Mamdani campaign in years to come as far as election victories. I think he ran almost a flawless campaign.
Well, and just
then you look at Virginia and New Jersey, and then those electorates are far, far more centrist, and they elected two centrist Democrat governors. And I think the lesson I would take and the lesson I'm going to bring to my committee is we need to understand our electorate, and we need to present candidates that both embrace our ideals, but also are electable. And I think that's what the Democratic Party did last night better than the Republicans.
And just notwithstanding the centrist positions or progressive positions of those candidates you just mentioned, do you think that those wins particularly represent more of a generational change in the terms of what folks are looking for as well? I mean, Mamdani is 34, I believe. You've got the folks who were elected in New Jersey and Virginia. Also on the younger side, like not as establishment, I would say.
Well, I think that's the natural progression. And I, you know, at the end of the day, I'm part of the old guard, I guess, and I don't want to be doing this forever either. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that, you know, more young people get involved, more young people get involved in both elections and in the party side of it. And, you know, that can only, it's only a positive, that would only be a positive result.
That's Steve Aguilar.
I hope so, is the answer.
Yeah. Steve Aglietti is the chair of the Sullivan County Democrat Party. Thank you so much for joining us.
You got it. Thank you.
And we'll check in a few minutes with the chair of the GOP, the Republican Party's chair, Rob Daugherty, in just a few minutes. But first, I'm joined in the studio by Jason Dole and Patricia Rubio, who did excellent work last night on election night and are back here with some results as well. Patricia, any key takeaways for you before we dive into Sullivan County results?
Yeah, the key takeaways was I think the write-in candidates made an impact. Maybe they didn't win all the races that they competed for. But I think, like what Steve said, it sort of gave a message out there that folks are willing to participate in the election process.
And Jason, any key takeaways that you noted? I got you on the wrong mic.
Yeah, just along those lines, you know, the bigger takeaway for me is the fact that there were so many significant write-in candidates. And what does that say about the state of both of the parties right now and how people are feeling about the pipeline to candidacy for local races? Because there's so many races that people run for unopposed altogether. And yet here are other races where somebody's running unopposed, but then somebody else is writing in. So I'm hoping in the next year that we dig in a bit more of that and see where that leads.
One of the more prominent write-in candidates was in the sheriff's race in Sullivan County. That was write-in candidate Tim Diamond. But incumbent Mike Schiff unofficially is won re-election with 64% of the vote. Joining us now to talk about the results from the Republican point of view, Rob Daugherty, chair of the Sullivan County Republican Party. Mr. Daugherty, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I just mentioned that win of incumbent Mike Schiff, Republican. How are you feeling good about that particular win?
Well, I was happy about that win because, you know, he was chosen at a convention to be our candidate, and then he won the primary. So, you know, to go on to victory, you know, it brings the party together a little bit more. And, you know, unity is a tough thing in the Republican Party, but I think we're achieving it now.
And how are you feeling about some of the races at the town level and the Republican performance in Sullivan County there?
So, you know, we had some wins. We had some losses, obviously, down in Highland. You know, Mel Carney lost. But, you know, Frank Matalone won, which was a nice win for us. You know, in my hometown of Bethel, you know, William Crumley retained his seat, and a newcomer, Adam Gold, is the high vote getter there. We lost down in Mamikaden with Dino, but Jimmy Post won. So, you know, we had a mixed bag, but overall, it was pretty positive.
And Are you happy with turnout? Do you feel that there was a good turnout in this year, you know, an off presidential year, but those local races really impact folks?
I mean, you know, when Mike Schiff ran last time, unopposed, he had 11-6. And I believe in this race, you know, we were touching, you know, we were over 13,000. So turnout was up. I think we need to do a better job of getting people out and getting them engaged in society as a whole, not just to vote, but, you know, more people need to get engaged.
And speaking of engagement, it seems that last night, at least on the national level, the Democrats were pretty engaged in some of those races, outperformed even some of their optimistic expectations. How does that play into your strategy at the local level for the midterms?
Well, so as far as the midterms go, I mean, the county Republicans are firmly behind Peter Oberacker. I had a conversation with him this morning about just that. We are firmly behind him. We feel he's a quality candidate. He understands, you know, the most rural congressional seat in the United States. Antonio Delgado used to say that all the time, and he's accurate on that. And we are firmly behind him here in Sullivan County.
And he is going to be running for New York's 19th district, challenging incumbent Josh Riley, for folks who may not be familiar. Also, Republican Sullivan County legislator Terry Bernardo announced last night she's going to run for Peter Oberacker's seats. I think you're driving there. Any comment about Terry Bernardo?
She ran against him last time, lost by 630-some-odd votes. Our county came out for her by 75%, you know, it was a 75-25, you know, which was a pretty big election. You have to remember the special election for Pat Ryan and Marcus Molinaro was on the same ballot. So it was a serious race. When you got good turnout, mind you, it was in August, when, as we all know, Sullivan County is pretty swollen at that time. I mean, she wanted to run. It's been her lifelong dream. I don't want to be a dream crusher over here. So, we're hoping that, you know, we are all behind her. I believe that we are all behind her. We've never had a senator from our county. It'd be nice to have a senator from our county. We'll see how it develops. I'm hoping that no one else gets in the race. I mean, she ran for it last time, and she has every right to run for it this time. I understand that someone is looking to get in the race, but they already sit in another seat, and they define themselves as America's Assemblyman. So if you're America's Assemblyman, it'd be very difficult to then run for the Senate, in my opinion. Mm.
That's Rob Doherty. He's chair of the Sullivan County Republican Party. Mr. Doherty, thanks for joining us. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again in the next year as we get toward midterms. Starting again already with the election season for next year. Thank you so much.
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you know, we're handing out petitions in February again.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, crazy.
Never stops.
But, no.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you so much for having
your time. Thank you. All right, that's Rob Doherty. He is the chair of the Sullivan County Republican Party. Back again with Patricio and Jason. Interesting there, Terry Bernardo just a few hours ago officially announcing her run, last night actually, for her run for state senate, the 51st district seat that's currently held by Peter Oberacker. He has, of course, announced his intention to run against Josh Riley in New York's 19th. Sounds like Mr. Doherty there was talking about some other people that might get in the race. So could be interesting there.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Just want to comment on what Rob said, you know, we're starting this whole process again. And for a lot of the town's supervisor position, this is just a one-year position because of the New York State law that was changed to have elections held on even years. I understand there might be a Republican lawsuit against that, so that may change next year. But this is going to be a short term for some of these supervisors.
Keep an eye on that, Jason.
Yeah,
I keep putting you on the wrong mic.
Actually, again, on a different mic here.
That's okay.
I'm moving around. But I mean, along those lines too, that also underscores for me what I'm hearing there is that, you know, the Republicans are already looking ahead to next year, and that just further compounds at that 1 year issue there.
Yeah. All right. Patricia, let's run down some of the Sullivan County results. I mentioned in the sheriff's race, incumbent Mike Schiff won re-election, defeating write-in candidate Tim Diamond. Tim Diamond did get 35% of the vote. And that is, making it and influencing the election there.
Yeah, these write-in candidates have made an impact, I believe. You say Tim Diamond is 35% of the write-in candidate, we suppose, because the write-in candidates haven't been
unofficial. Yeah.
Unofficial results. One thing that I'm looking forward to, looking towards, actually, is Fallsburg. Dick Stargardt won there 68%, and the write-ins received 31%. But there was other two write-in candidates for the town council. Miranda Behan, it looks like she will remain her seat. Michael Ben-Simone, which is the current supervisor now, decided not to run, started to run for the council. He has about 24% of the votes, but there's a write-in candidate. There were two of them, actually. And the write-in candidates right now got 26%, so we have to figure out who those candidates in, because that will decide the other seat that Ben Simone is running for.
Also, looking through some of the results in Forestburg, it looks like at the town council, Susan Park Landis, 33.8% of the vote, and Robert Sipos, 33.45% of the vote. In Liberty, Tory Johnstone and Brian Shorthall won town justice seats. There were a lot of unopposed candidates in these races this year. So those folks are obviously winning. Overall, it looks like incumbents held some key positions in the town of Highland. As we mentioned, incumbent John Pizzolatto from the Democratic line won 53%, beating Mel Carney 46%. The town clerk won unopposed. Chris Dickey in town council and Frank Monteleone won those seats as well. Also, proposition about reestablishing town constables, 57.78% voted yes to reestablish those town constables in the town of Highland. We're going to continue with our election coverage and get more results as we go around the region with our team. Jason Dole, Patricia Rubio, Kimberly Izar is here. But next, we're going to hear from our partners at The River Reporter about what's going on in Pennsylvania. It looks like there are some results that are pretty interesting. The full recap is next with Leah Mayo from The River Reporter. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
The need is growing. More families in our community are struggling to put food on the table. Local food pantries are on the front lines, but they need help. You can make a difference by donating non-perishable food, personal care items, and baby supplies, or by volunteering to support and distribute these donations. It's about nourishing our neighbors. Visit WJFFradio.org for info to help ensure everyone in our community has enough to eat. Radio Catskill, keeping our neighbors connected.
When I go,
you are closing that valve, pushing the air.
Ha, hey, up through this closed valve.
Asserting dominance, showing affection.
Wooing mates.
Communicating thoughts, ideas, feelings, emotions, and all of it is distinct to you. It's the voice.
The voice.
La voix.
Voice. That's on the next Radio Lab. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're going through local election results, and in Pennsylvania, Honesdale's mayor is staying put, and so is his opponent on the borough council, that is. Plus, voters statewide are keeping three Democratic state court justices on the bench for another decade. Liam Mayo from The River Reporter joins us now to break it all down. Liam, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Tim. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this. The mayor's race. Interesting. The two folks that were opposing each other, well, both of them won.
Yeah. It's strange to say, but it's true. So what happened was an incumbent mayor, Derek Williams, faced a challenge from a current borough councilor, Jim Hamill. Hamill was running both in the mayor's race and to retain his borough council seat. Derek Williams won by a significant margin in the mayoral race. He took 86.67% of the vote, roughly, with 822 votes to 348 as of our reading of the results. However, Hamill also was one of the councillors retained in the borough council race. There were five seats up for re-election on the borough council. There were five seats up for re-election on the Honesdale Borough Council. There were also five borough councillors running in that race. However, this election was divided into 4 4-year terms and 1 2-year term, and all five of those current councillors were running for the 4-year terms, leaving two new candidates to run for the 2-year terms. So currently the results have Kim Fish, William McAllister, Jason Newbon, and Jim Hamill retaining their council seats for 4-year terms, while current councillor James Cordaro loses out. And then that remaining 2-year term will be filled by Patrick Resty, a newcomer who sort of emphasized his experience in infrastructure. as a benefit to the borough, beating out Larissa Llewellyn with 55% of the vote.
And, normally state Supreme Court retention races are generally, well, our friends at Spotlight PA characterize them as, quote, low interest, low spending races that favor incumbents. But this year, the state Supreme Court retention races were really garnering a lot of attention. Talk about what happened with those races.
Yeah. So those races were, as you said, garnering a lot of attention, in part because of a perception from Republican, from the Republican Party, that these Democratic Supreme Court justices are biased in that way. And talking with some people locally who were sort of advocating against the retention of the justices, they were saying they took issue with especially some of the rulings those justices had handed out during COVID. The Democrats, by contrast, locally were saying that this really should be a no-brainer, that these justices are in part just helping to retain people's freedoms. They pointed out the justices' rulings striking down a map that they called gerrymandered from a few years back. So because the like rulings of state court or state Supreme Justices have become more and more important over the past couple of years with election challenges and kind of major things of that nature going on, there was a lot of effort put into highlighting those races. Across the state, the justices were all retained with around 61-62% of the vote. Locally in Wayne and Pike counties, there was kind of a stronger Democratic support for these, or stronger support to retain these candidates than there has been in races in the past. So around 46% of Wayne County voters voted to retain the justices, which isn't a majority, but this is a county that went 80 or 68% of the vote for Trump in 2024. So that's kind of a significant swing back in the quote-unquote Democratic direction. And a similar story in Pike with 52% of the voters going for retention.
And your roundup also in Wayne County includes a couple of other select competitive races. Let's get the results from Salem Township and then also in Waymart Borough.
Yeah, so just a couple of other races. Vincent Rivezzi beat Carolyn Hannell for Board of Supervisors in Salem Township. In Waymart Borough, Jane Farcoe, Darren Howell, Don Miller, and Shane Bailey earned election to Borough Council, beating out Chastity Babcock. But then another thing we've kind of been following is just turnout in these races. I think in part because of those retention races, and in part just because of high-profile local races like Homestead Borough, there was an elevated turnout in Pennsylvania this year. So Wayne County had 39% voter turnout overall, compared to about 5% less the last time there was a municipal election without kind of a nationwide race behind it. Similar story in Pike County, where there was 33% voter turnout overall, compared to around 5% less the last time there was just a municipal races on the ballot. And then in Honesdale, that kind of high priority or high profile race there earned 43% voter turnout, which is significantly higher even than the last time the mayoral position was on the ballot in 2021, where there was 35% voter turnout. So lots of people coming out to cast their votes this year.
Any other key takeaways for you from election night in Wayne, Pike County, Northeast Pennsylvania?
No, I think the turnout was sort of a big one, a big question that I've had and a big answer that we had after election night. And then just to highlight it, and in kind of another race that we were following in the town of Highland across the border into New York, that was another race with kind of a high profile local component to it. And that was a race that had 48% voter turnout despite sort of a county overall where there wasn't kind of a significant bump in turnout. So I think the story is that people will come out and vote when there's something locally important in their lives that they think is worth voting for and caring about.
Leah Mayo is the news editor of The River Reporter. There's more at riverreporter.com. Liam, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And of course, those results are unofficial. Some other unofficial results in Pike County, a couple of key races. We were looking at Milford Borough Mayor. It looks like Candace Mahala won that, the Democrat, with 63.5% of the vote. And Milford Borough Councilman, they're the top three, get in there. It looks like Maria Farrell, Doug Mannion, and George Lufty. I'll beat out John Messer for that. We'll take a break, and when we come back, let's look at the results in neighboring counties, Ulster and Orange. Looks like Democrats had a strong showing across Ulster, reflecting national trends. We'll break it down next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, a conversation on the market crash of 1929 and the parallels we can draw to today's market trends. Journalist Andrew Ross Sorkin talks about his new book, and today's financial landscape with entrepreneur Patrick Collison. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, joined in the studio by our team. It's Patricio Rubio, Jason Dole, and Kimberly Izar are all here to help us break down the election results. Kim, looking at Ulster and Orange counties, well, at least in Ulster, it looks like Democrats reflected the national trends and had a strong showing. Republicans lost several key county legislative seats. Let's get some of the highlights from Ulster County.
Yeah, Tim, as you mentioned, there was a bit of a blue wave locally that we saw in Ulster County. Countywide offices like Comptroller March Gallagher, Clerk Taylor, John Brock, and two judicial seats were uncontested due to the county's strong Democratic lean. But in the county legislature, there was a sweeping win for Democrats. 12 of 23 districts were contested. Democrats largely held their districts. In District 4, Berardi, District 9, Dooley, District 10, Marino, and District 11, Donovan, Republicans lost five previously held seats in the county legislature, which was a sweeping win for Democrats. And then also happening in the county legislature, voters stuck with familiar faces. 11 legislators ran unopposed, mostly Democrats, with two Republicans, Jason Kovacs and Kevin Roberts, winning as well.
So yeah, it looks like in Ulster, reflecting those national trends. What about Orange County? The two big races we were looking at there were in the county executive race and then the Middletown mayoral race.
Yeah, for the Orange County executive race, 339 of the 343 election districts have reported already. But County Executive Stephen Newhouse won with 43,555 votes to challenger Michael Sussman, who garnered 28,800 votes. And these are, of course, according to unofficial results posted by the Orange County Board of Elections. And then with the Middletown mayor, the race for the mayor of Middletown is now complete. Mayor Joseph DeStefano won with 2,600 votes to challenger Joel Sierra, and of course, according to unofficial results so far.
Yeah, it looks like the mayor, the incumbent mayor, won pretty handily there. It looks like, again, the takeaways I'm seeing here is like some of the national trends reflected in some of these races, but here in Sullivan, we're seeing like some of the expected winners, I would say. Like, I think folks expected Sheriff Mike Schiff to win in that race. But again, I think some of the headlines out of Sullivan, at least, are those write-in candidates influencing some of these elections a little bit more. They didn't win, but they maybe made a stronger showing than folks maybe anticipated.
Yeah, I have a feeling that that was so, like, especially like in the city of Fallsburg, when Brett Buddy announced his writing campaign, that's when Nathan Steingarter, that I noticed, started campaigning. He was originally running unopposed, and anecdotally, I didn't see in a lot of signs out for him, a lot of campaigning from him until Brett Buddy got into the race as a writing candidate.
Let's move over to Delaware County and some of the election results there. Again, unofficial results. Jason, what can you tell us?
Well, in the one countywide race that we can talk about for county treasurer, Republican Carly Pinner defeated conservative Rhonda Williams by a margin of more than 2,000 votes, 5,400 votes to about 3,100 votes. And that was in a race to succeed retiring treasurer Beverly Shields. Pinner pledged to run the office with honesty and professionalism. Next up, there's five town supervisor races in Delaware County. I just have to pause here to remind listeners that Delaware County is a little different than most of the other counties in our listening area. Town supervisor races have a bit more significance in Delaware County than they do in other areas because supervisors have more responsibilities. In addition to leading their respective townships, the town supervisors essentially also run the county. So like in Pike and Wayne County, you got county commissioners specifically elected those roles. Sullivan, Ulster, Orange, you have legislators specifically elected those seats. In Delaware County, residents vote for town supervisors who then make up the county's governing body, the Delaware County Board of Supervisors. That said, out of these five races, only in one of them did the incumbent not win, and that was for the town of Colchester. And Rob Haffley unseated longtime supervisor Art Merrill. Also what you're seeing a lot in Delaware County is a lot of unopposed folks in this particular race. Rob ran as a Republican, as a conservative, and on the Supervisor Rob line. Art Merrill ran on the Experience Matters line. Nobody ran on the Democrat line there. In the town of Hancock, incumbent Jerry Vernal defeated David Ribera. Meredith, in town of Meredith, incumbent James Ellis defeated Stephanie Monroe. In Sydney, incumbent Eric Wilson won over Giffen Ott. And in Stamford, incumbent John Cozier retained his seat against Douglas McCullen. So this is the town supervisors in Delaware County.
All right. And one of the other things that we folks may have noticed on the back of their ballot was Prop 1. That was something that had to do with, well, it's sort of complicated to explain, but it basically had to deal with tree cutting near a forest preserve in Lake Placid and how that wasn't allowed. But then this proposition would say that was okay, but you can't do it again, right? It looks like it's appeared to go and win or pass, sorry, by a slim margin so far, with 99.5% of the results in the New York State Board of Elections is reporting that 45.57% of folks are voting yes on Proposition 1 and 42.1% voting no. Well, before we wrap up here, I just want to get some key takeaways from you guys on, you know, what happened locally, but also just nationally. You know, when they talk about national elections, New York City is just down the road, I would say, from us. And there's been certainly a groundswell of media coverage and a groundswell of analysis about what that race meant or means. I just wanted to see what you guys thought about it. Kim, start with you.
Yeah, I mean, specifically with the New York City mayoral race, I think it's an interesting one. We've been listening throughout the day and we'll continue to hear in the news just about the historic nature of it. But I think a lot of people, they might be like, oh, New York City is 2 hours from the Catskills. But there's a lot of local impact here. I mean, there's a lot of folks live up here that live, work, go to school, commute into the city. And so how the economy is doing, how affordable, how safe it is really matters to our residents here. And then one thing I'd like to mention is that there is a direct connection. I mean, the Catskills provides more than 1 billion gallons of drinking water to New York City, fresh drinking water to millions of New Yorkers. And so there is a lot that I'll be looking forward to in the next few years. And just seeing how it plays out.
Patricio?
I'm already looking forward to the next election already, to be honest with you.
He's started planning already.
Yeah, we're already planning. Just to say, I'm wondering, on Kim's point, I'm wondering if this election in New York City is sort of a bellwether or a harbinger, or if that's the right word or not, of what the election is going to look like in the midterm elections. Is this a referendum against Trump's policies or what's happening here nationally? I guess it'll wait to see. It'll be interesting to see all this.
Jason, what do you think?
Going even bigger picture with this, though, what I look at is this was a local election year, so we were dealing with relatively low turnout compared to when there's a big national race. Everybody across the country was watching the New York City mayoral race, and that's what a lot of people are talking about and looking for indications as to what's happening. What shocked me when I was looking at results come in last night in a city of almost 9 million people, there was only about 2 million votes cast. So even in a big profile race that lots of people feel is a referendum on bigger things in our country, we're still talking about a minority of the citizenship going out to the polls and actually engaging in this process. And I think it's important for all of us to keep in mind when we talk about the electoral process, because there are threats to it. And I'm not seeing a major groundswell of participation.
But with that said, Mamdani got the most votes since the 1960s.
Well, that's good now.
That's approaching, you know, low voter turnout nationwide, but over a million was the first time in the city that's happened since 1960. So there
wow,
is this
so New
voter...
Yorkers really just don't go vote.
Well, I think nationally, though, this is part of a larger trend in these off-year elections where it's just low voter turnout to begin with. But this, to me, shows, despite what you're saying, and I get the numbers here, but it shows a little bit of voter enthusiasm in some ways. And I'm wondering what's motivating that.
Right. And I think, Jason, I definitely hear that point. And I think that when I was looking at some of the numbers, to Tim's point, it's more than 2 million voters, which
total.
Is the total, which is significantly higher. And also the way that people voted was interesting in New York City. There was a significantly larger amount of people voting on the Working Families Party line in New York City.
Which Mamdani ran on, and I believe he voted on as well.
Right. Mamdani showed up on both the Democratic ticket and then Working Families Party. And so I think that there's a lot of enthusiasm, specifically from younger voters coming up in droves. I think during the primary election, there was a significant amount of younger voters who registered to vote in New York City.
Yeah, and to that point, too, I think that, and I kind of mentioned this with Steve Iglianti earlier, too, like, is this a generational change? I mean, Mamdani is in his 30s, beating someone in his 60s who's a well-established name in New York politics. And, you know, some of the establishment at the D.C. level wouldn't even comment forward until late, or some of them not at all, to endorse the mayor-elect. And I'm just wondering, like, do we see this as like some sort of generational change of like, we need something different from what's been happening before?
I believe so. And it was sort of reminded me of what happened with Obama. When Obama was running for president, I remember during that time, it was a really surge of young people getting involved in the election process, sometimes even for the first time. And I think I saw that a lot in this mayoral race, that you have a young candidate with fresh ideas who reacting to what's going happening. And the younger generation saw that. And I guess I'm assuming they saw themselves for the first time, because usually they're not older gentlemen or older women running for this candidacy.
And I'd say that brings it back to the local races, too, though. When I think about generational change, I feel like that's a big part of what was at play at the most visible race in Sullivan County, which was the race for Sullivan County Sheriff. And then there is that question of what avenues to participation do the up-and-coming generations have? Because there's always going to be generational change, but like, how does it happen? I think that's part of what we're seeing with some of these write-in candidates in our area.
One thing I'll just mention with, you know, local races and then what we're seeing at the city and even state level is that a lot of these positions on the ballot yesterday, all of them require a collaborative nature. They're going to have to work with other folks in local and state government. For example, I think there's a lot of excitement with Mamdani's win, and now begins the hard part, right? I was reading New York Focus this morning, and in order for Mamdani to deliver on a lot of his campaign promises, it's not the city council that he's going to have to get the okay from. It's New York Governor Kathy Hochul, it's state lawmakers that will have to provide funding for a lot of those campaign promises.
And speaking of the governor, and speaking of moving on to the next election cycle, those are going to be some key races. The governor's race, there's going to be New York 19, one of the most hotly contested congressional districts in the country, right here in our backyard. Josh Riley now going against Peter Rucker, going to be in the primary there. But then what's going to happen then at the national level, at the midterms? What does that portend? A lot to look forward to, I suppose we could say, and a lot to work on. I want to thank the team here for all of the great work that you've done. Patricio Rabayo, Jason Dole, Kimberly Izar, and Genevieve Hartnett, not here with us this morning, but also contributing. Ronald helping us with some production, Ronald Kelson. Great effort, great job in getting out the information for folks. And again, the work begins now for next year. Thank you guys all so much.
Thank you.
And we also want to thank our partners at The River Reporter, the Spotlight PA folks, New York Focus, The Overlook, and The Times Union. You can read all of our election reporting at WJFFradio.org. Now turning to something non-election related, maybe something we need. She was Hollywood royalty, but also a fiercely loyal friend. Ann Talman takes us inside the world of Elizabeth Taylor and the shadow of her smile after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we talk comfort food from around the world with the beloved Yotam Ottolenghi. And we learn about classic German cooking with the wonderful Louisa Weiss. That's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
We believe nonpartisan, nonprofit news is essential to a healthy community. And as a Radio Catskill listener, we're guessing you feel the same way. We deliver fact-based journalism that holds the powerful accountable and keeps our community informed. Every story we produce is powered by listeners like you. And right now, through December 31st, your gift to Radio Catskill will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $1,000, by Newsmatch. Support local news and information. Give now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we've got Jungle Jazz by Xavier Cugat and Modesto Duran. Steve Allen plays hi-fi music for Influentials. And Mamie Eisenhower's favorite band, The Three Sons. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll get Ann Talman on the line here in a minute, having some trouble locating her. But as we had mentioned before, Zoran Mamdani won the race for New York City mayor last night, easily defeating former governor Andrew Cuomo. John Campbell of the New York Public News Network reports.
Mamdani is a 34-year-old Democratic socialist who will be New York City's youngest mayor in more than a century. His campaign energized young voters who turned out in droves to support his plans to enact universal child care and make city buses free. He thanked them in his victory speech.
Thank you to the next generation of New Yorkers who refused to accept that the promise of a better future was a relic of the past.
Mamdani's win puts an end to Cuomo's political comeback attempt. The former governor was trying to return to elected office after he resigned amid scandal 4 years ago. In Albany, I'm John Campbell for the New York Public News Network.
And as we said, Ann Talman is a Broadway veteran, filmmaker, singer, and longtime friend of Elizabeth Taylor. She's joining us now, and she's also bringing her acclaimed cabaret show, Elizabeth Taylor in the Shadow of Her Smile, to the Parlor Presents in Narrowsburg this weekend. Ann, welcome.
Thank you so much. I've been listening to your show for the last hour, so.
Well, thanks for listening. Wonderful. Thanks for being here. Let's talk about your relationship with Elizabeth Taylor. You were cast as Elizabeth Taylor's daughter in The Little Foxes when you were incredibly young, that play. How did that relationship begin, and what was it like stepping into that world with her?
Well, it was amazing, and we met on the very first day of rehearsal, and she was from that moment on just the most warm, wonderful sort of stepmother in a way. She sensed that I was motherless because, in fact, my mother had just died right before I got the job. And she just instinctively took me under her wing and mothered me for the rest of her life. And we were friends. The show toured for 18 months all over the world. And we were friends for life. Mm. And it was amazing. I had to audition twice for Lillian Hellman in her Park Avenue apartment. So I didn't even meet Elizabeth till the first rehearsal.
And as you said, your friendship with her endured long after the curtain fell. What surprised you the most about who she was off stage and off screen?
I think what surprised me was that she was a hilarious practical joker, which I talk about in my show. And she had the most delightful sense of humor and a famous cackle, which I do in my show. And she was very authentic and down to earth. And she loved being a mother and a grandmother.
Your show, Elizabeth Taylor and the Shadow of Her Smile, is described as a tribute, but also your own story. How do you intertwine those two narratives in the show?
From the time I was like a toddler, my mother noticed that I looked exactly like young 12-year-old Elizabeth Taylor from National Velvet. And she was the first person to say, oh, my God, you could play her daughter someday. And whenever it was on TV, you know, like old movies, reruns, the next day people would come out of the woodwork and say, oh, my gosh, you look like Elizabeth Taylor from National Velvet. And I was told that my whole life through high school, college, my first year in New York. And I was the cabaret intern at the Williamstown Theater Festival, and I sang with Austin Pendleton. And when he got the job to direct The Little Foxes, which was Elizabeth's debut, he had me audition, mm-hmm. and it was almost like the destiny came true. And Elizabeth, when she met me, she gave me a huge hug. She kissed my cheek, and then she whispered in my ear, oh, my God, I feel like I'm looking at myself from National Velvet. And it was just like, oh, my gosh, destiny, I guess.
You've got some music, some songs in the show.
Yeah.
What songs did you choose, and why did they feel right for capturing this bond between you and Elizabeth Taylor?
One of the first songs I chose was Long Before I Knew You, I Loved You So, is how it goes. And that was from the moment I started creating this show, going to be in it, because I felt like I always sort of knew her somehow, even though I didn't. And the song really expresses that I feel like I was always looking for mother figures, and she became my real-life mother figure, and I loved her. And the lyrics of it were just kind of perfect. Mm-hmm. And then another song is If They Could See Me Now, because it just sort of encapsulates dreaming about being on Broadway and then having that dream come true also. I do songs from Great American Songbook and Broadway. Another one is Mira from Carnival, because one of the lyrics is that she comes from St. Clair, and I grew up in Upper St. Clair in Pittsburgh, and so that song always meant a lot to me.
Is there a moment in the show that feels especially meaningful or emotional for you every time you perform it?
Actually, the part of the show that's about her AIDS activism and how she co-created AMFAR, and then the Elizabeth Taylor AIDS Foundation, and that's what Friends Are For, how that anthem came about. And Carol Bayer Sager was her best friend, and when they recorded That's What Friends Are For in 1985, she was in the studio, and they decided that all of the proceeds would go to AMFAR. And that's one of the most meaningful moments, because I was with Elizabeth in 1981 and 82 in London when AIDS started rearing its head, and she and I immediately lost friends that we loved, and I watched her just, you know, dive into action and use her celebrity for good with the AIDS cause. And every year I do an AIDS benefit on World AIDS Day. That's probably the most meaningful mm-hmm. moment in the show, believe it or not.
No, that's a very meaningful moment.
Yeah.
And You're a true multi-hyphenate, a storyteller, actor, filmmaker. You performed this cabaret in legendary rooms like 54 Below and Feinstein's and other venues across the country, and you're going to be bringing it to the Parlor in Narrowsburg this weekend. And, you know, 54 Below, Feinstein's, those other ones that I mentioned, they're intimate. They're legendary, but they're intimate. And I wanted to talk to you about, like, just performing in an intimate space, which the Parlor is as well, and how that, you know, helps the experience for you and for the audience.
I love intimate spaces like the Parlor. And my friend Elvira Tortora did her show, The Bookmaker's Daughter, at the Parlor. And she's the one who brought me to the Parlor. I love playing for 50, I've played for 50 and I've played for 300, but the intimacy of the size of the Parlor is really fun because the audience has shared with me that they really feel like Elizabeth comes alive as a human being and they see it up close because I really do kind of channel her. I always was a mimic, and I used to mimic Elizabeth to her, and she would just laugh. And so there are moments in the piece where I become Elizabeth, and the audience just loves it. And the closer up they are, the more fun it is.
And, you know, before we go, I just wanted to ask, what do you hope audience learn or remember about Elizabeth Taylor through your telling in the show? I mean, she was iconic in so many ways.
Yeah. I think that she was a down-to-earth, genuine human being. She was a mensch. And she had a huge heart. And that's the takeaway. People have said to me, oh my gosh, she became a person through people experiencing the show and her warmth and her generosity. She was so generous. Mm. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
That's
the takeaway.
Yeah. Well, folks can see Elizabeth Taylor and the Shadow of Her Smile at the Parlor in Narrowsburg, New York this weekend. It's Saturday the 8th at 7 and Sunday the 9th at 2. There's ticket information at myrivertickets.com. We've been speaking to Anne Talman, actor, singer, storyteller, filmmaker, multi-hyphenate. Thank you so much, Anne, for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, and I love your show.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, and thanks for providing us a little respite from some of the political news, too. That was nice.
Oh,
thank you.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
All right. Have a great show. Thank you.
Thank you.
That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can find the past episodes of this show and all of our locally produced show. There's so many great ones. WJFFradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Catskills Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at CatskillsPropertyCare.com. And from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hey, it's Jason Dole letting you know how you can help nourish our neighbors. More families are struggling to put food on the table. Local food pantries are stepping up, but they need help. You can donate non-perishable food, personal care items, or baby supplies, or volunteer to assist with distribution. It can make a real difference. Learn more at WJFFradio.org to help make sure everyone in our community has enough to eat. Radio Catskill, keeping our neighbors connected.
Radio Catskill depends on donations from our listeners, including donations from our listeners' music collections. People donate their music collections to us, we sell them to the next generation of music fans, and that keeps the station on air. Records, CDs, stereo equipment, and more. It comes from the community and goes back to the community, so Radio Catskill can stay on the air for the community. Donate your music collection today. Email feedback at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, cloudy and windy, a shower in spots late this afternoon. Some strong winds could cause localized power outages, so be sure to secure those loose objects, especially tonight when the wind advisory kicks into effect from 7 p.m. until 7 a.m. tomorrow. Very windy, occasional rain and drizzle this evening too, a low of 37. And then for tomorrow, morning rain shower to otherwise turning cloudy, high of 43. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.